Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show, everybody. How's everybody out there doing? Good to have you all out there today. The movie geeks are all here in full force. Myself, Jamie, Jerry, Chris. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Word.
Can I just tell you, it's nice to have the family back together again every Sunday. Feels good.
Dude, it's better than Eight Is Enough Christmas special, that's for sure.
That's what I love about you, Jerry, is the things you can pull out of your ass at a moment's notice.
Hey, dude, you'll be amazed what I can pull out of my ass and other people's asses, but that's beside the point.
License plates, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I
can't do the license plate thing, man, sorry. We're off to a good start. Kind of digestive system anymore.
Anyway, it's nice to have you all here, and that being said, we do have one interview next Sunday, but the rest of the time it'll be us again. So what's going on, guys? I want to start out the show with a throwdown. There's a difference of opinion here on Terminator Salvation. Maybe not as major a difference as I might want.
No,
there
I
to
don't
be.
Think it's what you want, but I want to hear what Chris has to say.
Let's hear it.
It hurts me to say, because I was really looking forward to this movie and was openly looking forward to it.
You really were. Show.
Yeah, I thought, as Bill Hicks would say, quick capsule review, piece of shit.
What didn't you like about it? That's what I want to know. What was your major beef with the film?
I'll start out, the story is ludicrous, and I know that sounds silly when we're talking about a movie about robots from the future, but, as it's playing out, you know, the first hour, you're sort of following the story along, kind of trying to figure out where it's going, but, of course, it's a Terminator movie, so it's about John Connor, and there is a cyborg that is being sent to kill him. And this movie's no exception. It has the exact same plot. It's John Connor, there's a cyborg sent to kill him. It's just not he's not sent to kill him in the same way that he was sent to kill him in the other movies. He wasn't sent to blow him away. You know, he was sent to bring him somewhere. And I hope I'm not, you know, obviously we're going to start talking about the movie in detail here, so
You're not telling, you so far have said nothing that's not in the trailer, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to.
You are, but I mean, not as much as you think.
But that said, you know, that's fine. They did a little twist on the story. Instead of a Terminator coming to blow him away, they get sent a Terminator that sort of gets close to him and sort of lures him into a trap, essentially. But once you step back at it, once you walk out of the theater and step back and look at that, it doesn't make any sense, because there's no way that they could know that this Terminator was going to come across Kyle Reese, and then somehow lose Kyle Reese, and then somehow come across the one person in the world that would defend him, and then take him to John Connor. Like, it makes no sense whatsoever.
I'll give you that. But what if I told you that I thought that plot device, the Sam Worthington character, the Marcus Wright character,
yes,
doing it, is so much better than I ever thought, given the movie, given everything behind it, and that Christian Bale's John Connor just, you know, he doesn't deliver. He just doesn't deliver. But
there's not much of a character there, ironically.
No, it's a lot of brooding, raging intensity. But where he fails, where Bale literally fails, Sam Worthington makes up for it in spades.
I will say there's two things that I did like about the movie. Number one are the performances. In fact, I thought Christian Bale did an okay job. But yeah, Marcus Wright character played by Sam Worthington is really good. And in fact, I went and saw it with my mother, and she afterwards was slobbering over him and wanted to know who he was.
And my mom.
I was saying to her, well, guess what? He's got another big one, Chambered, that's going to be coming out later this year. So you're going to get more Sam Worthington. But not
it's too bad. It's too bad that this movie isn't made for the mother demographic then.
it is in my family.
From what I'm just hearing from Chris, it is.
I think Jerry's family and my family are a lot alike. We've basically got a long history of just watching movies together and doing very little else. So,
all right.
Yeah, but that Sam Worthington's exploding, man. He's on. He's in Avatar, the Cameron film. He's out of nowhere. He's come up and he's a big career.
He's very good in it. He's good, and Anton Yelchin is also strangely in the same month. Embodies this character, and he really seems like a young Michael Biehn somehow. He doesn't really look like him, but somehow you believe
it. But he acts
The same way he did with Chekhov in Star Trek, mm-hmm. he really embodies this character, and you totally believe it. Once again, there's not much for that character to do. But the best thing I can say about the movie is that the action sequences are incredibly well directed.
Mm-hmm.
That is the one area that I think... McGee did an excellent job, and it's not like Transformers where it's up on the action, too close, and you can't tell what's going on. There's a lot of
isn't it wall to wall action though?
It is kind of. But I have to ask Chris. I like all the points that you like. What is it is it the plot that you didn't like? Is it something falls apart for you after the halfway mark?
After the halfway mark, exactly. That's when the plot starts to unravel and you start to see what's going on. First of all, I don't know if it's supposed to be a surprise, but the way the movie plays out, when it's revealed that the Marcus character is a cyborg, it seems like they wanted that to be a surprise, and it's not. It's not a surprise at all.
Not at all. It's revealed in the trailer, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it is revealed in the trailer, but then when you watch the movie, it's set up as a surprise, so that's a little confusing. And then, like I said, once you get to the halfway point, you realize that this Marcus Wright character is leading him to go to, Skynet. And then it really starts to come off the wheels because we got to talk about the Arnold cameo, first off.
Which I just sort of wrote out of my mind because I thought it was so cheesy that it was just such an obvious thing to get the hardcore fans.
It was one of those really awful moments, and that's one of the plot points. They get this Terminator to lure him to Skynet, and then they basically the place is essentially a Terminator factory. Like these things, they're just like there's an assembly line of Terminators coming
mm-hmm.
on, and they've only assigned one of them to take on John Connor, the one guy that they've been trying, and it's the same Terminator that they've sent twice before to try to kill him. It didn't work when we sent it back in the future. Now we've got him in our factory here. We're just going to send one. One will do it. And they just send this one Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator to kill him. And
who hasn't looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger in at least 10, 15 years.
it doesn't even look like Arnold from 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, this thing looks like a cartoon. It looked awful. I mean, that moment really took me out of the movie big time because it's a great idea. I love the idea of having the Arnold Terminator.
Well, maybe when they did the special effects with Arnold, they ran out of funds, kind of like the state he's governing.
It's
dude,
very,
it's so
very
scary,
popular.
Man. It's so scary that you may be right.
Well, they're broke. It's a broke state.
No, they're broke. They've been broke. Let me tell you something. When I lived there in 2002 and 2003, nothing has really changed. I mean, Gray Davis was the governor. Yeah, they're broke. They've just been broke for 6 years.
They need to put new state taxes on fake boobs. I think that's the surest way to...
I don't know, dude. The state that you guys live in, you have enough porn stars in the Tampa and Lakeland area to... okay.
Yeah, they're a hero right now. Go ahead.
Sorry. What Schwarzenegger should have done was, go on set. He could have gone on set and filmed that scene in one day. and then taken his fee for the movie and given it to the state or something, you know. I mean, that would have made more sense.
It
would have made a better movie too. It really would have, because that moment really takes you out of it. Like they literally and in fact the Skynet computer says, first of all, it's one of those movies where the Skynet computer explains the whole plot, what it's trying to do to the Terminator at the end of the movie, to the Marcus Wright character. Here's what's happening. Now we've lured John Connor back, and there's no way you can stop us. And then they send the one Terminator, which has failed to kill him before, after him again. And of course, it doesn't work. They blow away the Terminator, and John Connor gets away, and he gets his scar. You know,
the scar was the only thing I had a problem with, because it's like that thing in the Wolverine movie. We have to do this. If we don't do this,
it was very forced.
Yeah, it's very forced. But I have to say, for a movie that a lot of people wanted to go in hating, ever because of the Harry Knowles review. You know, I just really, the Harry Knowles review, I'll be very honest with you, I was just like, my God, what did they do? Did they not give you enough craft services on the set? It was just like, it made no sense to me. It really...
No, I agree. Harry Knowles was a little too extreme. He had nothing good to say about the movie.
Yeah.
I do think that the performances are pretty good, and the action is one of the best action sequences I've seen in a long time. The beginning shot with John Connor in the helicopter.
The helicopter is pretty impressive.
That's an excellent action sequence, but then there's lots of ridiculous action. While it's shot very well, what's going on doesn't make any sense, you know.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
In the middle of the movie, we've all seen the scene in the preview where the giant Transformer-esque robot is, you know, it's got a machine gun for a head or whatever, and this thing, these people are just sort of talking, and this thing just sort of shows up, and no one hears it. I mean, the ground quakes when this thing moves, but no one heard it coming. It just reaches in and grabs people. There's a lot of moments, and the one thing I will say about Harry Knowles' review is he was right about one thing, which is every scene is like a tick off. Every scene has the potential to work really well. Every scene's got something in it that works really well, be it original concept or an interesting robot or a good performance or well-directed action. But there's something else in it that makes it not work. You know, one of those other elements is off. None of it comes together all in the same scene in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that robot just shows up out of nowhere and upsets the scene?
Yeah, it really does, actually. In fact, that's quite true.
Was it played by the cinematographer?
World scene,
they're starting to get into a conversation about humanity and what's left of the human race, and they start to talk about it, and all of a sudden this robot steps in and starts to, you know, like drag it back into Transformers territory again.
Was it played by the cinematographer? That's all I want to know.
No, I think the problem with Christian Bale and his blow.
Good for you!
The problem with Christian Bale is I think he knew he fucked up. He realized that when McGee offered him the script originally, he should have taken the Marcus Wright character. There's a reason John Connor is a supporting character. He's a plot device in this film, nothing more.
Yeah,
and that's the problem. And it becomes painfully aware halfway through the film that, wow, as much as we all like Christian Bale and think he's a great actor, John Connor as an adult is not that interesting of a character. Now, having said that, I think Marcus Wright is an extraordinary character and actually redeems this film. Obviously, Chris doesn't think so, and I understand why people would hate this film, but the problem with the John Connor character is they have a text that sums up, you know, gives you what's happened in the film in the beginning after the prologue, and that John Connor is not considered, like, he's not the immediate leader of the resistance. He's considered by many to be a false prophet. They never play up on this. If the film, to me, has a flaw, they never really play up on this fact. They never create any tension in the resistance.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly my problem with the movie. That was just another case where the movie comes. This is not like Wolverine. And I shouldn't have said, you know, like Bill Hicks said, quick capsule review, piece of shit. It's not a piece of shit. It's not Wolverine. You know, that movie is just awful. There's nothing redeeming in that movie at all. But this movie does have some redeeming qualities, but unfortunately those redeeming qualities aren't all firing on the same cylinders at the same time.
Right.
They're all over the place. And this movie is more like, you know, when you're in trouble as a kid, that was one thing, when your parents are just yelling at you, but it's worse when they tell you, I'm disappointed in you. And this movie was disappointing, you know, because it had so much potential and started to capture on some of that potential at so many points during the movie and just never follows it through. It's just all a little piece off. And another thing that Harry Knowles was quite right about, I think it was Harry Knowles that said it, was Danny Elfman's score, which is just very indistinct and uses little pieces of the original score, you know, that driving mechanical score from the first two movies, but doesn't use it as effective, nearly as effectively as they did in those two movies. And it's just another thing that is coming real close, but not quite there. And you kind of have to see the movie to know what I'm talking about.
Well, the hope would have been that McGee would combine, obviously he can direct action, as he's proven. Obviously he can direct character, which he's proven with We Are Marshall. The hope was that he could combine the two and in a story that, for those first two films, had a lot of great visceral action, envelope-pushing action, but it also worked because it had a heart. And from my understanding of what you're saying, Chris, and to a lesser extent you, Jerry, that's what this film's missing more than anything.
Absolutely. It has no heart. And speaking of heart, this is supposed to be post-apocalyptic. You know, they have nothing. You know, I mean, it's just wasteland. There's a lot of things that don't make sense, like where are they getting their food from and how are they all surviving? I mean, I understand they make a couple mentions of, you know, they can grow, you know, some carrots or they eat coyote meat, but everybody is ripped and everybody, you know, has, you know, incredibly white Simon Cowell teeth and everybody's got these incredible hairdos and things like that. And then in the end of the movie, you know, they've got John Connor hooked up to an EKG, and I had a hard enough time buying that they had an EKG machine that worked there.
I felt bad for them because, you know, if there is going to be, there are obviously originally two more, and the most important part of the film can't be part of the next two films.
Well,
that's
exactly,
my problem with it. That's my problem, is that if this is a trilogy, the thing that makes this film work, the thing that I think that actually is Marcus right. Well, he can't be in the next two films.
Because why is that? Because he gives up his heart. Because John Connor, first of all, they just give away this throwaway line. And maybe it's because I'm in the medical field, so that kind of stuff bothers me. But they say, oh, his heart's not going to take it. Well, okay, fine, I'll deal with that. But then they do this, like, half-assed heart transplant, you know, and it's just like he just, like, they unzip Marcus Wright and, like a tauntaun on Hoff and rip out his heart and, you know, like, and just throw it into John Connor like he's draining a three or something like that. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. There's another, one more scene in the movie that is asking you to suspend your disbelief, and it was just one scene too many.
Well, I don't know that there'll be two more.
I don't know, because if this thing is behind, is going to come in number two this weekend.
That's another thing.
Hang on. Let Chris speak.
I will. I've been very kind.
This is important.
I will eat a little crow here. Once again, I was way off, and Jerry, you were too, actually, and Jamie, once again, was right, but even Jamie overshot it a little bit.
No. Don't quantify it, my friend.
No, Jamie was closest in 2 points. Jamie was closest in money. He predicted $60 million for Terminator and $75 million for Night at the Museum. And, of course, that means he predicted Night at the Museum would be the bigger earner, which it was. Either of them made those two amounts, but Night at the Museum was the bigger earner.
Thank you.
I just
want to sit on this for a second. Hang on. All right,
yeah,
I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Okay.
You shat on it.
So what's the upcoming? What do we got to predict now? The upcoming next week's release.
Well, Up is the next release.
Yeah.
Up,
wait. Oh, Shelley brought up a good point. Wasn't Aaron who said it would do $101 million?
No, he said $100 million.
Yeah.
For Terminator.
Yeah. Wow.
Predicted Terminator would be number one. Yeah.
Well.
Yes, he did. Well, at least I didn't go that far.
No, none of us did.
Well,
and,
you know,
and the thing
apparently
about that
he has no foresight. What?
Or foreskin.
The thing about that is Jamie's right. I don't know if there is going to be that part two. It's not going to make a difference. It's not going to be a part two or a part three. I don't think.
Yeah. So
Jerry's...
I think this thing ends. My problem, if I have a problem, it's that, you know, there's an interesting book waiting to be written about Christian Bale's choice here. I mean, he was offered the Marcus Wright part, and he said, no, I want the John Connor part, and I think you guys need to beef this up.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lesson to be learned here. Like, you know, John Connor, as an adult, the way these guys are writing it, at least, he's not that interesting.
Well, I'd like to know what that script was like, Jerry, because I think you're right. I do think the Marcus Wright character and the Kyle Reese character are the two more interesting characters in this particular script. So what would that script have been like? Because you know it was very different. It would have to be. So that probably would have been the better movie, but that's not the movie they made.
No.
Again, like, the action sequences in this movie are great. I'll say that. But like I've said 1,000 times before, and I'll say 1,000 times again, that's not enough anymore.
No,
good
it's not.
Special effects aren't enough. And actually, this movie has great special effects up until that Arnold Schwarzenegger scene. And really, I recommend everyone go see this movie just to see, just so that you can call me up and we can shit on it together. Because that Arnold Schwarzenegger moment, it's one of the worst moments I've
seen in recent
film history.
I don't know what, that's the one thing, like, I didn't even mention that when talking about it, because I just think it's a nothing scene. It doesn't do anything to...
Except for this incredibly sophisticated and powerful machine front has the one guy who can defeat them, and they bring him in there, and they have one Terminator go after him. And they're literally in a factory, a Terminator factory. I mean, they should just completely blow him away the second he walks in the door. But no, they've got to set it up so that the Terminator can walk towards him in slow motion, purposefully, and the machine, the supercomputer, can explain to the Marcus Wright character exactly what's happening. It's just like in the Austin Powers movie when Dr. Evil says, no, I'm just going to close my eyes and assume that everything went to plan, you know? Like, it's one of those endings.
Did you think, though, before the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, the thing, or whatever you want to call it, shows up, I was under the impression that the Sam Worthington character was going to be in a kind of, you could say, a reboot kind of way, the Terminator that John Connor sends back to protect.
I think a lot of people were saying that. A lot of people were saying that he was going to develop into the Arnold Schwarzenegger, the T-100 or whatever model. That's another thing. There's so many Terminators, you start to get confused about who's who and which Terminator is what and can do
what. And
what
the warranty is on each of them.
Right. Exactly. Is this thing allowed to use a microwave or will it... Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense.
All right. Okay. I had something in mind to say, but let's get off of Terminator for a moment. No, this is what I wanted to say. It's back to Terminator already. See? A short-term memory. If you remember, it was just a month ago when they were trying to figure out a way to put Arnold in this movie. So that was really a last-minute thing. They weren't able to develop as well as they should have.
I would have left him out.
Yeah, they should have left him out, because it was a good idea to bring back one of the other Terminators. It's another touchstone, just like little pieces of the music and the lines. Of course, you got the lines in there, like, I'll be back,
come
with me if you want to live, and all those kind of things. It's fine to want to have those little touchstones, but if they couldn't get Arnold, then try and get Robert Patrick. If you couldn't get Robert Patrick, then try and get Christina Loken.
I wouldn't have even tried to get anyone. I would have left it alone, because you're trying to start fresh in one sense, and I really wouldn't have even... The Arnold thing you're just like, okay, I mean, you know, it's like, look, the Arnold in Terminator 3, I actually think this is better than T3, but, because I think T3 is just a blatant cash-in.
Yeah, see, that's the way this feels to me, too. I mean, I maybe one's better than the other, but they both just feel unnecessary and kind of half-baked.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they both want to have it both ways. They both want to start over, but they also want to take some of those touchstones from the first two movies and sort of incorporate them. You know, we don't need to hear characters saying lines like, come with me if you want to live, just so that the audience can go,
I agree with you. I mean, like, look, I like it. I have problems with it, but I like it more than I hate it. Trust me, the things I have wrong with it, but not enough to just give a Harry Knowles kind of, like, evisceration of it.
Okay, Film Festival. Film Festival, they announced their winners earlier today for us. And the Palme d'Or this year goes to Michael Haneke's new film, The White Ribbon. Michael Haneke, who, you know, American audiences might know. Yeah, Hannity and Combs, The White Ribbon. As long as it's white, Hannity and Combs are behind it. Michael Haneke, who American audiences might know for Funny Games recently. So The White Ribbon, it's a stark black and white drama set in Germany at the end of World War I that won the Palme d'Or. The best actress was the lead actress of Von Trier's Antichrist that we spoke of briefly last week, which bears a little more conversation.
You just want to talk about the fox that talks.
No. Chris, have you read about the particulars of what's in this film?
No, I haven't. I'm very interested.
It climaxes, and for those of you that might be easily offended, mute your computer. It climaxes, and this is shot by Anthony Dodd Mantle, the guy that just shot the most beautiful movie last year, Slumdog Millionaire. A close-up of a clitoris being cut off with a pair of rusty scissors. Yes. It actually inspired four people to faint in the theater, booing, and a special anti-prize, actually.
Yeah, I read that yesterday.
for being so misogynistic. Which, that's one of the things I like about Cannes. Everything's a scandal. I like that. That they're so passionate about movies that they can be absolutely scandalized by them still. I think that's great, actually. But IFC has picked this up, so it will find distribution here in the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's good. I mean, I think even if I don't know anything about this movie, it's kind of like we were saying last week. I don't have to know that they cut a clit off or anything like that. I know that it's Lars von Trier, and it's a horror genre, whether you want to call it thriller or whatever. That's enough for me, and that does sound like you're getting into a little bit of torture porn territory there. But I find it difficult to believe. That's a climax for a movie like this. That's not you don't get. That would be the opening scene in a Saw movie or something like that.
Yeah,
we've seen worse than that, you know.
Yeah, I hate the term torture porn and the hell with David Edelstein for ever coming up with it in the first place because it's a stupid term. But it's Lars von Trier. He can do whatever he wants, and people are gonna watch it, and we'll watch it. So I mean, hell, I watched Dogville and Mandalay and The Boss of It All in the last couple of years. So sure, we'll watch it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, enough about that story. And then Ken Loach's new film got a special ecumenical prize.
Something this year?
Yeah, they really dug his film.
Well, they dig his stuff because The Wind That Shakes the Barley was very good. That was an awesome film with Cillian Murphy, so yeah, good for him.
Yeah, and Tarantino's the performance of Inglourious Basterds that everyone's raving about from the German actor. That got Best
Walt.
Actor.
Yeah,
I got Best Actor this year there. So, and about the Tarantino film, you guys have read reactions, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What strikes me about the critical consensus on this film, which I think the only overwhelmingly positive review came from Todd McCarthy in Variety, the thing that surprises me most are the criticisms that we could have predicted before you even walk into a Tarantino film. Too talky. I mean, you're watching a Tarantino film. Why would that be a criticism of a Tarantino film?
Yeah, I thought that was bullshit on everyone's part. Of course it's going to be talky. That's what he specializes in.
Well,
yeah.
And actually, also, that's the thing that a lot of people... Well, I mean, I like that. I like that he's going back to talky, because that's what made Reservoir Dogs so great. You know, there's not a lot of action in Reservoir Dogs. There's not a lot of action in Pulp Fiction. There's not a lot of action in Jackie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Kill Bill and the Grindhouse movie... Death Proof, those were less talking and more action, and it didn't work as well. I like the Kill Bill movies, and the Death Proof movie has its positive points, but he's better when he's writing characters who are just sitting in rooms talking.
Chris,
what Tarantino does so well.
You didn't like Death Proof. I had dinner with James Gillette this weekend, and we both remember your review of Death Proof. You hated it, okay? You had nothing nice to say about anything with Grindhouse.
There are some things I like about it.
I
agree. I did not like the movie.
You liked it more than Transformers. We'll give you that.
There are things that I like in it. No, I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying I like it, because actually
right.
I watched it again, and I still did not enjoy it. But it has some positive points in it. But overwhelmingly, what I think is negative about it is he got away from his roots, as it were. He isn't writing characters that are talking about something. The conversations that they were having weren't natural the way that they were in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown.
Right, right.
They were just sort of talking in between action sequences, and it didn't make any sense.
First of all, let's get back to this. You had dinner with James Gillette.
Yes, I did.
Who we all of our show fans know as one of the co-creators of The Shark Is Still Working. We featured him several times on the show in the movie. So that must have been an enjoyable dinner.
Oh, it was great. We had a great time. I knew he was going to be in the area because he's working on some stuff for a documentary he's working on for some clients, and we had a great time.
Okay, what'd you say about me?
I said that you were the nicest American I've ever met, online, that is, of course.
Wow.
So, he only had great things to say about our show.
Yeah. Well, we love him.
He's great.
So Tarantino, apparently not enough action. The climax didn't work for a lot of people. Yet I'm still very excited about it, but there might be some trimming that happens with this before we see it here in America.
I don't think there's any trimming.
Well, if anything, some people are saying he might put stuff back in. He might put a couple scenes that he wants that he didn't get to put in for Cannes. He might want to put those back in because he's well under his contractual obligation to come in at, I think it's 2 hours and 48 minutes, which is a long movie.
Yeah.
And Tarantino himself has said that he regrets several things that he cut out of Kill Bill. There's several scenes that he would like to have put back in there.
I look forward to those several scenes.
Yeah, I do too, actually, but that's, who knows.
Oh, my God,
folks. We'll get those.
Jamie, you cannot erase that line. That's an awesome line from Chris. We can never erase that from this show.
What line?
That he he's curious about those parts, too. I mean, because I've never gotten the impression that Chris was that enthusiastic about the Kill Bill movies like I was, so...
No, he likes Kill Bill. You like Kill Bill quite a bit, right?
I do like Kill Bill, but I don't think... I mean, it's definitely his weakest... I put it well behind his first three movies.
Yeah.
But I like those movies, and I also will say that I don't think time has been terribly kind. Again, he was using some dialogue that was just a little too forced. It just seemed a little bit too cutesy, you know what I mean? Like, look how cute I am, look how cute my characters are, look how...
Tricks are for kids,
yeah. Yeah, tricks are for kids and all those kind of lines, and, just a little bit too cutesy. That said, I think if you sit through the Kill Bill movies and you just don't like them, you find nothing redeeming in them, I think you're kind of an asshole because they're a lot of fun.
Dude, Chris, my opinion of you has always been up, but it just went way up, So, because I thought you hated those films, so, I mean, holy
no,
shit.
No. In fact, I said that when Death Proof came out. When Death Proof came out, what I said was, Tarantino is now, for the first time in my life, for the first time that I've been following his career, he's in a position to have to prove himself back to me, because I didn't expect Kill Bill to be Reservoir Dogs. I knew going in that he was trying to make a big, fun, kung fu action movie, and that's what it is. I just don't think, and I like it for that. I just can't gain as much from watching it. I don't get the kind of emotional response that I get from watching the first three movies.
Right. Okay, I got you.
It's going to be a fascinating career, too. It's going to be a fascinating career trajectory because he will have misses. What fascinates me about Tarantino is there is all this youthful, ultra-geeky enthusiasm that you associate with young filmmakers coming out of the gate. How will that mature, or will that mute as he gets older? And by all accounts, he's making his World War II movie with Inglourious Basterds, which would, just on that alone, would point out, maybe this is a serious venture, but it's not necessarily. He's still playing the genre. He wants to make a spaghetti western set in World War II. He wants it to be his tribute to Sergio Leone.
Well, he wanted to make this movie, ever since Jackie Brown. He talked about making this movie, and it has gone through many different revisions. So it's curious to see how this will play out. But
it's also a testament to Tarantino that he still has, not just among our show, but among many, many people, his name immediately gets people's attention. Whether even if it's the fact that he's producing a movie, with Rolling Thunder, or especially if it's one of his own directorial or writing efforts that comes out. Immediately, that grabs a lot of attention from people. Like this Inglourious Basterds is a perfect example. It's another. How many World War II movies have we seen in the past 10 years? We've seen a lot of them, and a lot of them came and went, and too many. But this one immediately grabs everyone's attention again, and that's a testament to him not only as a filmmaker and a writer, but as a personality too. He's really exciting.
Yes, he is.
He just sort of lights a fire under everybody, and you get excited about what he's going to do next.
Tell you, one of the things that Tarantino is most known for is his use of popular music in films.
Mm-hmm.
You like that? You like that
yeah,
segue?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's an awesome
smooth as butter, baby. Which can be traced back to, of course, a Scorsese influence, possibly. Do you have favorite music cues from a Tarantino flick, Chris? And then, Jerry, we'll go to you.
I think it's perfect that you use this as a transition because, yeah, I think that Tarantino is probably one of a handful of filmmakers, along with Scorsese, who uses music, pop music, better than anyone. And, yeah, the examples are just too numerous to count. They're in every movie.
Yeah.
Whether it's Stuck in the Middle with You during the ear-cutting scene in Reservoir Dogs, I mean, that one is kind of hard to forget about. You know, and all the old songs that were stuck in his supercomputer mind,
mm-hmm.
It's not like he got people to write these songs for him. He always uses music that's been around for a long time, and either people forgot about or they just somehow never heard. Like, think about the first time you saw the Pulp Fiction trailer and that Miser Lou, that Dick Dale song, which, you know, I'd never heard that song before, but as soon as I heard that, I was like, what the fuck is that? That is a badass
right,
guitar
yeah.
riff, like... And it was so exciting, and I still get excited whenever I hear that song, and I associate that song with that movie. That's an interesting thing that he does, is every time he uses one of those music cues, it's so hard to disassociate that music from that point on with his movies. And a perfect example is that guitar music that he used in Kill Bill in the House of Blue Leaves scene when Lucy Liu and her crew, the Crazy 88, are walking down the hallway.
That's incredible.
That single
music.
Guitar riff. And that's the thing that bothered me so much when Michael Bay used that exact same riff in Transformers when the Camaro comes back, Bumblebee comes back, and he's the brand new Camaro. And he uses that same, you can't reuse a music cue that Tarantino's used because he just impresses on your memory that music cue. And
well, you know, there's some music cues for lazy directors. I don't think that, you know, we might have our own opinion on Michael Bay, but I think he has a good work ethic. I don't think he's lazy necessarily, but
I think that was a very lazy choice. I think that was extraordinary.
No. That's what I'm saying.
Because I don't think people realize where that piece of music comes from in Japanese Kinji Fukasaka's Battles Without Humanity. Hey, you laugh at me now, but it comes from the Japanese Godfather, you son of a bitches. So
there's that license plate again.
You know, it comes from that. And
look, I'm saying that it's a lazy choice.
It is ignorant. I think when a commercial uses it, it's ignorant. But it actually does come. It's very appropriate for Kill Bill because.
Okay. Before you guys jumped down my throat earlier, I was actually
because I have no desire to go down there. I mean, your esophagus does not interest me. So. I'm here all week, folks. All week. Buy me some wine, I'll be your best fucking friend. Okay.
Okay, so I think it was a lazy choice. But there are, with music, there is a tendency to be lazy, and there are songs that spur a recognition that kind of do the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like the song At Last, the Etta James song, for a certain
mm-hmm.
mood.
Yeah.
For Bad to the Bone, the guitar opening guitar riff in Bad to the Bone, and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah, those are very lazy choices. And then also, sometimes an entire a movie can use a single artist, and I always find that interesting. It's very rarely done well.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Of course, you know, like The Graduate used Simon and Garfunkel. And then
Magnolia.
Magnolia used, what's her name?
Amy Mann.
But they used
Amy
that,
Mann.
I thought, with great success.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
absolutely. When someone uses a single artist.
Lazy, though. Lazy. I think the Remember the Titans soundtrack is the epitome of laziness in the last decade.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, I just threw that out there. I threw that out there because you guys used the term lazy, and I felt, my God, let's throw out the soundtrack that has every cliche on it.
Well, did that use some of those that Jamie's talking about? Like, you know, if it's a romantic moment, you use That Last, or if it's a badass walking out of a bar, you use Bad to the Bone, or, you know, something.
No,
is,
but
is that what you're talking
about?
No,
but it uses a lot of Motown songs in a movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, and I you know, look, hey, that's a cheap shot. I realize it. I know that if we're really worth our salt, we'll get hopefully a lot of hate mail for that comment, but...
Well, but that's one of the things. No, I think it's a valid point, because... It is interesting how one choice can be lazy because it has been used so many times. But then you get a good, like what I'm talking about with Tarantino, a lot of these songs, whether it's Miserlou or, you know, a band like the 5678 from Kill Bill, or some of the great obscure music that he used in Jackie Brown, like Across 110th Street.
Oh, that was incredible. And then there's another one that he uses. There's some obscure track he uses. I don't know the name. It's one of my favorite tracks off the CD, but...
Yeah, that's the thing, because you know when they make movies, it's not like they try lots of songs sometimes. You know, a filmmaker might be filming a scene and saying, oh, I love this song. Like, for instance, Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Now, the defining song of that book, the song that they touch on in that book over and over again, is Sympathy for the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
But when Terry Gilliam went to make the movie, he tried it with that song, which is a great song, and he loved
beautiful
the song,
song
too, but it didn't work because the tempo of the movie starting out of the gate, it's just too rip-roaring, and, they're firing across the highway in this machine, and you don't want this slow, meandering Rolling Stones song. So they had to go with Big Brother and the Holding Company song, which has got a little bit more of a driving force to it. So, you know, that's the thing. Like, you know that Scorsese and Tarantino, they've tried these other songs, and you got to go back and say, no, that's not good. I got to dig a little deeper and find something that works better.
At the same time, I think a lot of the reason why the music in a Scorsese or a Tarantino film works so well is because it's written into the script.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the script is kind of developed, the scenes are developed around the notion of using that song, particular song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he uses a Bowie song in Inglourious Basterds, which is
totally
time inappropriate, but
it
could catch a mood. And they're generally very, very good at using music that isn't so dead on. Like we've been talking about, obvious. If you look at a movie like Casino, which, you know, this 3-hour and 15-minute epic, and it's scored with songs, with popular music, beautifully, as most Scorsese films are. There's one piece of music plays for about 2 seconds that I thought was beneath Scorsese because it was too dead on. And that's when Sharon Stone runs off with James Woods, and Pesci comes over, and they get in his car in the garage so they won't be overheard by surveillance. He turns on the ignition, and "You Can Go Your Own Way" is
mm-hmm.
playing on the stereo.
That's
the one moment where I thought, oh, maybe that's a little too dead on. But
on the nose, yeah. Right.
But Love is Strange, all the other great stuff that he came up with Robbie Robertson was just incredible. He's been doing that since Mean Streets. You know.
Yeah.
He started it in Mean Streets, and he did it very well in Goodfellas, too. That's probably my favorite Scorsese music cue is the Harry Nilsson song, Jump Into the Fire, when everything's sort of coming off the tracks or coming off the rails for Ray Liotta towards the end of the movie, and it's got that incredible drum solo. And everybody knows Harry Nilsson. We've all heard Coconut and Without You and things like that, but
mm-hmm.
Jump Into the Fire is one of those 8-minute tracks on a record from the 70s that everybody sort of forgot about. And he brought it back and used
mm-hmm.
it incredibly well because the title of the song is Jump Into the Fire, and that's kind of what Ray Liotta's doing. The
mm-hmm.
title is on the nose, but it's not like the guy is screaming Jump Into the Fire while it's on screen. You know, he's not shoving it down your throat and punching you in the face with it. He's just using it in the background with those drums to make you feel a little off easy. I feel like I'm on coke every time I watch that scene because, you know, it's so intense and so haywire.
Yeah, amazing use of music. And also he has a tendency, like he uses classical or operettas to score some of his movies too, Scorsese does, even though, you know, he'll use a composer for something like The Aviator or something.
Right.
He goes to Howard Shore quite a bit. And that's similar in tone to what Kubrick used to do. Kubrick used to always, go to the classical over an original composition. Okay.
Sorry, I thought
back to Kill Bill, actually. Kill Bill Volume 2.
Please.
There's a piece of music that's not on the soundtrack towards the end of the film where she has done the five-point exploding palm thing or whatever the hell it is, and she, you know, he asks, how do I look? And she says, ready. And then there's this beautiful piece of music, must be from Italian.
With the horns, those horns.
And it's not on the soundtrack, but it's a beautiful piece of music. I don't know what it's called. I used to research it a while ago and it stopped. But I just think that's a beautiful piece of music.
And
sadly, it's not on the soundtrack.
No, but that's... we should mention that one of the heirs to... We talk about Scorsese and Tarantino, but another one of the great heirs, not only in filmmaking-wise, but in use of pop music, is P.T. Anderson.
Yeah,
of course. Of course, not with his last movie, and not with Punch Drunk Love either, although there was a little bit of pop music in that. But with Boogie Nights and with Magnolia, he really, especially Boogie Nights, like some of those songs were, of course, they're of the age and they're a little bit disco, but they're sort of interwoven into the story very, very well and very, very seamlessly.
Right. So much so that you, and they're definite, if not homages, which could be a little limiting. To say that it's an homage to this, it's just part of their DNA. It's how they conceive of movies because they grew up
right.
on the Scorseses, you know. But you know, if you think about the Sister Christian, the Night Ranger, in Boogie Nights.
Yes.
If you think what was the 80s song playing when the 80s came around and William H. Macy ended the party with killing himself? What was that song?
Oh God,
I don't know.
I don't know.
That. I like that, whatever it is, even though I can't remember it.
Yeah, well, the Sister Christian thing is a good point, because that scene is, you know, I mean, that's one of the most intense scenes in the last, you know, 15 years in movies. And if you were making that movie, would that be, when we talk about lazy choices, is that the scene, is that the song that you would pick? I mean, that's not a tense song. It's like, I don't even know what the hell that song's about, if it's a love story or what.
But
that's not the song that you would immediately jump to score
for
that scene.
Yeah, exactly.
Somehow he used that song, and the way he used it, and the way he had Alfred Molina singing the song and sort of doing the piano and talking about his mixtape while that song is blaring. It works really, really well.
And the firecrackers.
Adds to the tension, and then it cuts into Jesse by Rick Springfield in that scene.
That's
also,
right.
Which is another one. Another one that would not be the first choice, but it works for that character.
That's a very important point. A lot of times, and it happens with your choices as an actor too, a lot of times when you make counterpoint kind of choices, the effect is even more profound.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows how to do it, particularly in those scenes. Actually, Miss Movie in the chat room brought up the director I was going to bring up next, which was Cameron Crowe. If you think about someone that definitely devises his scripts around certain song choices,
mm-hmm.
never more profoundly than in Almost Famous, of course. Cameron Crowe's the one. Even in the movie that doesn't work from him, the whatever that monstrosity with Susan Sarandon was. What was that called?
Elizabethtown?
Yes.
Did you think it was really a monstrosity, though?
I thought it was pretty borderline pretentious, embarrassing. But there's one just incredible scene where you feel like he is at most himself, in that road trip where she makes the mixtape for him.
Oh, yeah, that's the money shot of the whole film.
Those are the moments I fell in love with the movie. Yeah.
And that's true with singles as well. I mean, he has this thing when it comes to music, contemporary music, he's incredible. I don't put that past him. He's very good when it comes to that.
I do want to mention, we were talking earlier about when they use a single artist for a movie to sort of define that movie. I think Juno did it really well last year with the Moldy Peaches and also
Kimmy
Dawson, who's a member of the Moldy Peaches. And that wasn't exclusively their music, but their music was predominant in the soundtrack of the movie, and they kept going back to it and sort of defined that Juno character.
You know who was originally signed on to direct Juno?
Who's that?
Brad Silberling, and he'll be on the show Wednesday. Thank you.
Wow, that's a great segue, Jamie. That's awesome.
I'm the king of segues, man. And of course we've talked about it ad nauseum on the show, the Leonard Cohen and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. The chemistry of that film would be completely gone without the Cohen songs.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Which, of course, were pre-existing pop songs. So I also think when I think about music, surprising musical choices, Don't Stop Believing in Monster, the Journey song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When they're making out in the back of the bar.
Right.
Yeah, and also the other Journey song when they're roller skating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty good choice.
The best Spike Lee song cue. a change is going to come from Malcolm X, which actually Spike Lee said himself, that's the best music cue I've ever done. I always found that song incredibly moving anyway, but never more so in a film than that moment in Malcolm X. Because he knows he's about to die. I mean, he knows it in that film.
That is a great one, but I'm partial to some of the music in Summer of Sam also.
Ooh, that's great music there.
Or ABBA, the Dancing Queen, of all freaking songs for that scene, and somehow it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And the Who song, the big, wasn't it the Who song that they used?
Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yeah.
The whole big montage, which in terms of musical montages, man, that's one for the books.
Yeah. Well, he did it again, and he got Game actually too with not necessarily in the movie, but he used the Buffalo Springfield song that the Public Enemy they sampled the Buffalo Springfield riff, and that song is forever linked with that movie in my mind. Also.
Right.
Well, He Got Game is a nice example of two kind of seemingly polar opposite musical styles.
Exactly.
With the Public Enemy music interspersed with the, help me out, who's the composer?
Aaron Copland.
Yeah, the All-Americana on the basketball field. Gorgeous. He is such a passionate filmmaker. I see such passion in like every frame of his movie, and there's an energy and a catharsis in his movies that does it for me. So any other directors? Wes Anderson was brought up in the chat room.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting one for The Life Aquatic, all the David Bowie-inspired songs. This is a beautiful soundtrack, and also there's just so many. I don't know. He uses a lot of Indian music on the Darjeeling Limited and the Who and the Kinks, and it's just it's a really
all the British invasion music from Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums is almost entirely British invasion artists, and
he's just incredible. I mean, he's actually really picked up where Cameron Crowe leaves off almost as far as that goes. I think he's done an incredible job.
Yeah. And actually, you talk about Indian music, and I think of Oliver Stone and his Natural Born Killer. Well, he obviously has a thing for Indian themes anyway. But, you know, the chant in Natural Born Killers with the prison riot, which that artist completely disagreed with using it for that movie.
Right.
Because he's a artist of peace, and it's in a pretty chaotic, violent scene in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was just one more cherry on top in terms of controversy for Natural Born Killers. I think that was the least of Stone's worries with that movie. But I do think, actually, Stone's an interesting one, too, because obviously he's made a lot of movies with some pop music choices, and some of them work really, really well, although I think his some of his choices tend to, not that one, that's a good one, but some of them tend to be a little bit on the nose sometimes, too.
Right.
Okay, speaking of Cameron Crowe, as we were earlier, here is his choices for the top 10 music moments in film. Okay, you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Number 10, Where Is My Mind from the Pixies and the Fight Club.
You just mentioned one of my favorite bands of all time, one of my favorite music cues of all time. And I love that book, and I love that movie, but wouldn't that be that ending is completely different from the ending in the book.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And with the use of that song, it worked incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly well. Oh, that's a great choice.
There's a choice, I can't pronounce it, from Talk to Her, Kakurakuku Paloma from Talk to Her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that's a good choice. Anything that you would use from Almodovar is good.
Yeah, which actually people love his movies too in Cannes this year. Edge of Reality from Elvis Presley. That's like musical though. I mean, it's Everybody's Talking from Midnight Cowboy. These are more like things written for a movie. I don't know if And of course, Jump into the Fire from Goodfellas is on there too.
Is it really? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Number 5 is Tubular Bells from The Exorcist.
of course.
Going Home from Mark Knopfler from Local Hero.
Okay. That's a good choice.
Falling Slowly from Once.
Oh, I would. Yeah, definitely. Once I think is going to be on a lot of people's lists.
The Rolling Stones, Royal Tenenbaum's selection, She Smiled Sweetly and Ruby Tuesday.
Ah, which they reversed.
That's a great choice.
Yeah, but that's an interesting scene because they made the conscious decision to put them backwards. I think She Smiles Sweetly and then Ruby Tuesday in the movie, which is actually reverse of the way that they appear on the album, which wouldn't make a difference except for they're sitting and listening to the album. So it's an interesting idea.
Right.
An interesting moment where they probably tried it, Ruby Tuesday and then She Smiles Sweetly, and it didn't work. So they had to revert for some reason. So that's an interesting choice.
And Cat Stevens for Harold and Maude, which another artist-film association that works very well.
Yes, it does.
You can't not bring that up. There's actually another director who's very good at his use of music, and it all goes into his singular talent.
Oh, I want to guess. I want to guess before you say it.
Creating mood and atmosphere. Who am I guessing?
May I guess?
Yes.
David Lynch.
No. No,
Steve
very
Oliver.
Close. I was about to say Lynch, but actually I'm talking about Michael Mann. Because
I would have been my second choice.
Yeah, and sure, early in his career he was a little too consumed with Tangerine Dream, but but if you look at something like Heat, this is another example of he's got maybe 30% original score, but most of it is from other sources.
Right.
Very, very versatile group of sources too. He has like Moby that closes the film. He has, I think, another Moby that's a Moby tune that covers the bank robbery, the centerpiece of the film. I believe that is amazing music that just all captures that mood. And when you're trying to capture something like L.A. and he shot at 85 different locations.
Yeah.
And all these different flavors that this music creates, but it's all trance-like.
The
club scene in Collateral.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh, my God, it's great. It's so
or
good.
The use of the Audio Slave song, Like a Stone, in Collateral also, when the wolf appears in the in the roadway. That's excellent. I never even liked that song till I saw that movie, and I thought it was used so well that I liked the song from then on out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, also Lynch, certainly, when you talk about atmosphere, I like his sound design in general because he knows that he's got incredible visuals outside of Inland Empire, and he can his sound will do as much work for him as anything else will. If you look at it, Fire Walk With Me, the sound design itself is just incredible.
Oh, that bar scene is one of the great uses of. I mean, there's no lyrics. There's just that like driving blues sound in that scene. So loud that they had to put subtitles on the characters because he was not willing to turn the music down so you could hear what the characters are saying because the music works so damn well.
Yeah. Yeah, very impressive. There's also let's see. He put some more choices here. Cameron Crowe did. Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time from the Delfonics and Jackie Brown?
That's a good. That's a great tune.
Yeah.
Right, and that song in that movie turns out to be kind of a plot point too, because the Robert Forster character goes looking for the tape, and then he's listening to it over and over again, and the music keeps coming up.
But that's the great thing about like Cameron Crowe, but also about Tarantino, is he mentions these bands, he mentions it in the movie, and you're so curious that you want to go out and actually seek out the music beyond the soundtrack.
Yeah. Well, Reservoir Dogs is a prime example of that. I mean, it's not only. All the music cues in the movie are tied together by, Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s, Stephen Wright DJ character. It's not just songs that work for the movie. This is the station that all these characters have been listening to, and we know that. We heard them talking about it at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
This is what they're all listening to, whether they're in there listening to it at that moment or whether it's Chris Penn driving around in his car listening to it. You know that they're all listening to these same songs at the same moment. Chris Penn was probably listening to Stuck in the Middle with You while he was driving over there at the same time that Mr. Blonde was cutting off Marvin Nash's ear.
Yeah.
There's an interconnectivity. We're talking about Counterpoint, and I think this is a good place to close off this conversation. Probably the greatest example of a song working in counterpoint to the scene itself is... Clockwork Orange, Singing in the Rain.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
I knew it.
I mean, is there a better example?
No.
Really?
No.
No, really, there
I
is
mean,
not.
You can think of other examples, but I'd be hard-pressed to think of one, to mention one that was better. I don't think there is.
I can't think of a better way to end it, yeah.
And you're just, it's just, it's the happiest song ever written. It expresses such an unadulterated joy for life, and he's using it for a brutal rape scene.
Yeah.
And it is that much more chilling because he uses that song.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Brilliant. All right. Chris, I know you got to go out to eat. You're off the hook. 7 o'clock, my friend. Top of the hour.
Hey,
look at me.
I appreciate it. Okay, Billy, Super Sounds of the 70s keeps on trucking.
Yeah, keep on trucking, baby.
So we'll see you next Sunday, dude.
Yeah, see you next Sunday, man. Have a good one.
All right, good night.
Good night, buddy. We got some good shows coming up, Jerry. I want to tell everybody about them.
All right.
Did you like the way I said your name?
Yes, I did. That was very,
Jerry.
That was very cool. That was very
Thank
cool.
Thank you. I know you like it.
Yeah, it was like...
This Wednesday, we have Brad Silberling, whose new movie is Land of the Lost with Will Ferrell. You looking forward to that one?
Well, after talking to him especially, actually, because, I mean, it sounds a lot of fun. I mean, nothing more, nothing less. But I got a pretty good idea of what they were trying to do after talking to him the other day, so it should be cool.
Yeah, and we have Paul Salamoff, who is the author of a book called On the Set, The Hidden Rules of Movie Making Etiquette.
I bet Christian Bale didn't read that.
Yeah, it should have been required reading. And also, I'm trying to get somebody to come in to talk to us about Cannes and the films there from someone that has actually seen them all.
Right, that would be cool. I would really appreciate that, yeah.
I'm doing it because I know that you'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
If I can please just one person.
Yeah, please one person. Please the co-host.
And then all throughout the month of June, every Wednesday, we have these special themed shows. And starting next Wednesday, we're starting a new series called Inside the Classics. And we're going to be tackling Gone with the Wind, because there is a wealth of material out there about Gone with the Wind, and surprisingly, there are two new books about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
One about the director, Victor Fleming, who's kind of like a forgotten director. He
made all the great films of that era. I mean...
And he did Wizard of Oz, did Gone with the Wind in the same year.
It's
surprisingly,
incredible.
He was the replacement director for both of those. It was the same kind of situation.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a fascinating conversation. And there's also Molly Haskell has a new book out called Frankly, My Dear. It's another examination of Gone with the Wind with her very unique take on it. Very enjoyable.
That is true, yeah.
And then we'll be talking about actually the movie and the talents behind it, including Fleming and Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh. So it'll be a nice change up from talking about the latest movies at the multiplex.
Have you ever seen Gone with the Wind in the theater?
I haven't in the theater.
It's you have to really see it on a big screen to appreciate it. It's quite, it is quite a film. I've seen it a couple times in the theater, and it's just, you really do. You lose so much on TV. It's not even funny.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous, like, it's one of those gorgeous Technicolor experiences. I mean, forget about everything else.
Yeah.
Just the colors. There was something about Technicolor that was ultra real, but surreal at the same time.
Yeah.
Very special. And then we're going to be tackling the new classics. The idea is to alternate between, you know, the classics that we all know and love, like Gone with the Wind, and then what we believe will be the new classics for our generation.
That's right.
And first up will be Heat, speaking of Michael Mann, his great use of music. Which, is there a better Cops and Robbers movie?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's Cops and Robbers squared. And then the plan is, this is all kind of tentative, the plan is to celebrate the summer of 84, as we did last year with the summer of 83. 25 years have passed. In connection with Aaron's show, Back by Midnight, where he takes May-June releases from the summer of 84 on his Tuesday night show.
Mm-hmm.
We take July-August on our Wednesday night show. And then he also has a Thursday night show where he'll bring on critics to talk about that year.
Right.
So that's the plan. So we have movies like The Last Starfighter, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, Purple Rain, that kind of thing.
Now the Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, though, is an October of 84 release, so we don't mind going, we're not just doing the summer, we're doing the whole year, or?
Yeah, I had its release date, as something like August 24th.
Okay, it came actually on my birthday that year, October 3rd.
Maybe it premiered somewhere on August
24th. Yeah, I think it premiered, but yeah, because I remember I wanted to go see that for my birthday, but no, that's awesome.
Those are some of the movies that we'll have to tackle. Red Dawn.
They're remaking Red Dawn. I don't know how you remake Red Dawn, but they are remaking it.
Do they replace the Russians with the Iraqis or something?
No, I think they replace them with the Chinese, I think, is the plan. But I really honestly don't know how you remake it.
Well, if they do that, we're screwed, man.
We're fucked.
Too many of them.
Yeah, we're fucked.
And then the week after that, we have our big Hal Ashby tribute. As we said, that we've been doing, going to be doing that for a couple of months now, because the new Ashby film comes out June 30th on DVD. The Looking to Get Out,
right?
So that should be an exciting show too. And in between, we have some surprises. Gosh, I hope so. I'm waiting for a big surprise to hear whether or not we have this big surprise on Tuesday. So the second I know, all of our listeners will know too.
Cool.
And, of course, anyone that has any ideas for content, just shoot them our way. We didn't predict for Up, man.
Well, we could. I would say that's going to be the big one, just how big is the it's an iffy thing because, you know, it's getting very good reviews, but I don't see it as strictly a kids' movie.
Well, do you see other Pixar's as strictly kid movies?
No. This and WALL-E definitely are not strictly. These are, like, really all ages, if not skewing a little older. But this one, I don't know. I want to say 60, 70 million at least.
Okay.
I mean,
does it have competition? Competition doesn't matter, but
Competition doesn't matter, but does have Drag Me to Hell, which is a big deal because of Sam Raimi's Return to Horror. So
right.
That is a big deal, and that's going to eat into anything that the Terminator audience would be. So.
Yeah, obviously not fighting for the Up crowd.
Yeah. I mean, so it's going really for the Terminator and other genre picks. So. But Up,
well, let's look at this. Up, WALL-E on opening weekend made $63 million.
Okay, my thing's not that off.
Yeah. Up will be more or less, what do you think? Actually, I'm surprised by the box office since Wolverine for some of these movies that haven't been as robust as Wolverine was.
That's true. So I'm going to say that like 65, 70 million for Up.
Okay.
That's my prediction.
Okay, I'll predict 75.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think Chris is predicting $200 million.
Wow, man.
Since he's not here to defend himself.
Yeah, oh, my God.
No. I'll find out what Chris thinks, and I'll share that with everyone.
But I would be surprised if I would think Drag Me to Hell would be second, though. I would be really surprised if it's not.
You think so? I don't know.
I mean, so far, the people who've seen it say it's good. So, and I think there's no horror movies like The Strangers last year anywhere around. So I think it just, by default, it has the chance to do really well.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I will definitely like it, I'm sure. I saw the Cannes press conference with Raimi. And he really does sound like a Boy Scout. I mean, he sounds like a little kid that has a genius brain.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah, and everybody was so excited. It is exciting that he's returning to that genre in between Spider-Man films, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody actually in the... There's no holds barred at these CAD press conferences. I love it so much. There's no thought of, you know, maybe that's inappropriate. Somebody stood up and they said, did you essentially want to return to form to your old horror movie genre after seeing the Spider-Man 3 wasn't that good?
point. That person's got a point there. I mean,
and Raimi was like, "What? Spider-Man 3 is no good? What?" He said, "Wait a minute. That's great. That's great." Have you watched any of this canned stuff?
I haven't watched it. I've just been reading it online. I haven't watched any of it though. I can imagine it's pretty crazy. I would love to have been there for the Antichrist screening though.
Yeah, me
that
too.
That must have been insane.
I love that. I love the scandals that come out of Cannes, and it can only help the film. I mean, people that I remember first hearing about Von Trier is actually from Cannes, because Breaking the Waves was heralded as this just enormous breakthrough,
right?
Incredibly heartbreaking movie, and so that's what turned me on to Von Trier.
Right.
Yeah. And then I saw an interview with, what's her name, the Howard's daughter.
Oh, Bryce Dallas Howard
for
Mandalay, I guess, because she had the Nicole Kidman part from Dogville.
Right. She was on Howard Stern the other day, and she was talking about all of her nude scenes at Mandalay. So I'm sure there'll be a spike in rentals for, of all things, Mandalay this week.
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think that's a safe bet right there. They might be very disappointed, but...
yeah.
Those films are not easy to watch. Dogville, Mandalay, Boss of It All is a little bit more back to form for him, but those two movies, they are chores if they sit through. I don't care who you are.
Yeah. So, is there anything, what are you looking forward to on the movie front? More than anything, right now.
More than anything, you mean within the next couple of weeks, or indefinitely, or...
Well, I mean, would you say summer's been disappointing so far?
I would say I like Star Trek, I like, and I like Terminator more than I thought I would, but Wolverine, Angels and Demons are kind of what I expected, I guess.
Right.
But, the big ones really haven't played yet. The really big ones, like Public Enemies and Inglourious Basterds, haven't played yet. 500 Days of Summer hasn't played yet. There's a couple others, but Inglourious Basterds and Public Enemies and 500 Days of Summer are the ones I'm really looking forward to.
Well, those are big for us. I'm sure they'll be big enough in the box office, but those are big for us in terms of movie lovers, of geeking out about these movies. When we looked at Vay, week after week after week, we thought, oh, God, these are all home runs.
Yeah.
And so looking at the returns on a holiday weekend, so obviously we have one more day left of this holiday weekend.
Yeah, but it's not looking, I mean, it's an underperforming weekend, but I'd have to say Star Trek is not only the best film of the May, but it's the best film of the year. I mean, it's not a great genre film. It's not a great Star Trek film. It's just a great film.
Yeah, and that's so far. It's at $177 million. Mm-hmm. So that's going to cross $200 million easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know, Jamie, because June, I mean, I think there's some interesting things coming out in June. The Hangover, I think, has the potential to be very funny. You got this Transformers thing, which could be okay. You have Year One, which is Harold Ramis coming back. But I think the Michael Mann movie, Public Enemies, is kind of the big question mark, because we have Johnny Depp and Christian Bale going head-to-head.
Serious, artful movie on the 4th of July weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Night of the Museum, it's also worth mentioning, while 53.4... maybe I was expecting it to be a little more robust. It actually, the first one was a massive hit, and its opening weekend was only a little over $30 million.
Yeah, so I that's done very well. And also, that was going to be number one, because you can take the whole family.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you can't compete with
See,
that.
See, I knew
right
you'd
now.
Come around. I knew you'd come around.
Well, I didn't think it wouldn't be. I thought that would be.
Well, you said it wouldn't be.
Wait, did I say Terminator?
Yes.
I must not have read Harry Knowles' review then. no.
Look
I
at
was,
you trying to revise your...
No, I give you that. No, the family movie, if I've learned anything this year, it's the Paul Blart rule, is if you have a family movie, that's the one that's going to do well right now, because you can take everyone to go see that.
Right.
But I have to say, this year has been a year of tremendous disappointment, even before the summer started. There have been a couple of high-profile disasters, not disasters, but disappointments, like the two Clive Owen films, The International and Duplicity, I thought we'd be talking about them long after they came out, and they just really fizzled on arrival.
I don't think June looks. I actually don't think June looks very good. But this is another thing about Transformers.
I'm going to see Transformers with Chris.
I actually will go to the theater probably to see Transformers.
Mm-hmm.
Much to the chagrin of people very close to me. But
yeah, you're going to get killed.
Yeah, right. But this is what passes as intense anticipation for a Michael Bay movie. This is how they promote it. It's the latest ploy they have to promote this. The first Transformers used 35 terabytes of computer space for the rendering of the special effects. This one uses 140 terabytes. Doesn't that say it all? I mean, really?
I thought you were going to say it's better than Pearl Harbor. That was going to be the...
Well, the my home movies are better than Pearl Harbor.
Oh, man, that's funny, man. I'm like, my home movies are... Anything's better than Pearl Harbor.
Anyway. Okay, is there something else pressing that we want to discuss before we log off for tonight?
I would like to... I've actually seen a couple of other films.
Oh, cool.
I saw the Jim Jarmusch film last week, The Limits of Control.
Yeah.
And I just want to make a comment. I like Jim Jarmusch more than a lot of other people. I had seen Stranger Than Paradise in high school, which is, if you're keeping record, 25 years ago. And I like his films. And with this film, Bill Murray only has a small part, but there are a lot of like Tilda Swinton's in it, Gael Garcia Bernal's in it, and everyone has like cameo appearances. It's the first film that I've seen a lot of like hardcore critics, like who always defend his work, just ragged on it. And it goes, it's like the antithesis of Angels and Demons, where if I said Angels and Demons and The Da Vinci Code were like too much exposition, this is like really no exposition. But if you're willing to stick with it, it's kind of it is interesting. I don't think it's better than Broken Flowers or Ghost Dog or Dead Man. Although it does have it's very challenging, like Dead Man. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think you the people walked out when I saw it. But it's a worthwhile film. You just your curiosity, like you can see the people who financed it. Well, okay, it's Jim Jarmusch. We're just gonna let him do what he wants. And if it was another filmmaker, they would have probably like, we're not putting any money up for this. But it's curious. But I was just really shocked that a lot of people, the critics really ragged on this film, people who would normally defend him, and they just like really wrote him off this time. That's the only thing I really wanted to say. But
your defense of Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah.
You know, it's I actually think it's great that a Jim Jarmusch film is in two theaters.
yeah, exactly.
I'm all for counter-programming, man. I'm all for having a choice to see something completely different, especially during these summer months when everything is the same big movie, essentially.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, but that being said, I mean, I can't say that I'm a huge fan of Jarmusch.
He's an acquired taste.
Yeah, and maybe I haven't eaten enough of him, so I haven't acquired that taste yet.
That's a really sick image.
But Broken Flowers I did enjoy, mm-hmm. but did I enjoy it because of Bill Murray and not necessarily any other reason? Because it's a pretty, route kind of movie. It's you know, anybody could have really written it. I don't know if they could have had that tone. Maybe that's particularly Jarmusch. But
yeah, that and the other one he did about the taxi cab drivers, Night on Earth. Those are
right.
by far his most mainstream movies.
Right, right.
And I don't know if we'll ever get those again, but those were by far as commercial appeal goes, those were the widest that I think he's had so far.
It is interesting because these are directors that came out of the independent artsy movement in the 80s or the early 90s. It is interesting as that movement changes and morphs, and it becomes less distinctive from the mainstream, because obviously all the mainstream studios bought out the indie studios.
They did, yes.
How these film directors maintain their voice, or where they go, or what consumes them now, or if they're irrelevant, if they're directors of that time, and that's where they are, or if they advance with the changing business. Has Jarmusch done that? Is Jarmusch relevant as he was with A Stranger Than Paradise?
That's a really good point. It's some of these directors. I guess the other director you have to bring up is Hal Hartley.
Yeah.
You know, he's another one that is an acquired taste, and one I actually really identify with very strongly, his first couple of movies especially. But
somehow he's still making movies.
He's still making movies, although he was on Terry Gross on Fresh Air back, I think it was 2000, and he had actually said something very honest about the whole indie film movement. He said, if you're still making indie movies without studio support at my age, with the amount of films I've made, you're doing something wrong. He was very hard on himself at this time.
Yeah.
Now, this was before we had the thing, he made the sequel to Henry Fool, which was also...
Which I did see, yeah.
Yeah, and which was, though, he had that distribution thing where you could, was on DVD and Magnolia Pictures, I guess, or HDNet on their thing. But he was very hard on himself for a long time because he never felt he really made it. And I don't know if he... Even after that, I don't know if he has anything in the pipeline or not, but he was his harshest critic.
Yeah, and I did see, what was that movie called, the Henry Fool sequel? Fagrim. Fagrim.
Yeah, Fagrim, that's right.
Yeah, starring the two most eclectic, weird actors.
Parker Posey and Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, it was actually a dream combination.
Yeah.
They should get, like, Goldblum and Walken together. That's the combination I want to see.
There you, that would be cool.
They can out-weird each other. That would be great. You wouldn't be able to follow any conversation in that film. It would be terrific.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, he's still making movies. Who are the relevant directors? I don't know. But there's something that happens, and we've talked, this is a very interesting point. And I know that we've covered it before on the show. Not so much with directors, though, but with actors. Because when you look at a Pacino or a De Niro or any of the great Hoffman, any of the great actors from that period where in the 70s, they were young, they were hungry, they had something to prove. And that goes with age, doesn't it? I mean, and that would affect filmmakers, too. So do you become, did some of these guys become less relevant now? But isn't it just because you've reached a level of comfort in your own life and you no longer have that hunger to prove that you can change the face of the art form? You know,
right,
like
right.
De Niro and Taxi Driver. You know, maybe that's unfair. But I think it's more unfair to rag on them and say that they suck somehow. I just think they're at a different place in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what interests me about Tarantino, like I said earlier, with that enthusiasm stay when he's in his 50s. It stayed with Scorsese. Scorsese's right there at Cannes.
You know
with
who
his...
else stayed with Spike Lee? It's still there with him. He has that kind of enthusiasm. I mean, so there are a couple of things. I'm very curious to see what happens to Tarantino.
I think with Spike Lee, though, where his particular brand of passion comes from, I think he's still pissed off. I think
that's good, isn't it? I mean, that's...
Yes. I think that won't go away with him, which is great. But Scorsese, it's still a passion. It's still like a childlike enthusiasm for movies. And I saw his press conference about his World Cinema Preservation Society.
Right.
Which is what he unfolded the next stage of at Cannes. It's a beautiful idea. And somebody got up and asked him, how are you, what's the viability of this movement, preserving older films, previously unheard of films, unseen films, when everybody's going to see and everybody's making a Terminator? And he said, well, the hope is that we get these into the bloodstream and you'll see fewer Terminators from those future generations of filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was beautiful.
Right,
I think that's the worthy cause.
Mm-hmm.
But he still has that passion, man. That's what's
great. He's there. It's totally there. And you can't fault him there. I mean, he really, Spike Lee, Martin Scorsese, and Tarantino, and to an extent, Kevin Smith, too. I have to put him on this list, too. I want the guys who really love movies to make movies, to keep making movies.
Yeah.
And they are the guys that I really go to. They're the ones that, and this, I guess, goes for Wes Anderson, too. I see it in him as well. But Scorsese and Lee and Tarantino, I want them always to be making movies because they really love the art form.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to.
We were talking about Hoffman earlier, and actually that's a valid, this goes with my theory, because Hoffman was quitting acting. Nothing was igniting him.
Right.
And he was gone from acting for a little while, and his wife said, you need this. It's part of you. It completes you.
Yeah.
Everything doesn't have to be a masterpiece. Do it for the love of it.
Yeah.
So he is in that stage in his life where he is doing it because he loves doing it. Everything
yeah.
doesn't have to be Midnight Cowboy.
Right.
And there is a particular joy as people that love acting in movies as we do, just to see an old pro at work. That comfort. And it's so completely comfortable with Emma Thompson and Last Chance Harvey. And,
totally.
And those years of experience, just, you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, that's the end of my tirade.
It's not a tirade, it's a damn truth.
It's a good conversation.
Yeah.
So for Wednesday, Brad Silberling, great guy.
Very nice guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah. Land of the Lost. And hopefully a Cannes report. And great theme shows, like we said, Gone with the Wind, Heat, Summer of 84, Hal Ashby. Got a monstrous June. Even if there's nothing good at the multiplex in June,
that's
you can
right.
still come to us for good,
yeah,
good
really.
Movie material.
Yeah, really, come to us, please.
Right. So, all right, my friend.
All right.
Good times.
Good times, great times. Thanks, everyone, for listening tonight.
You see that we have Betty Joe? We have, like, movie
Betty
royalty
in
the chat room?
We got everyone, yeah, but Betty Joe, that's awesome. Hi, Betty Joe.
Movie royalty, my friend. That's
yes.
right. All right, guys, we'll talk to you on Wednesday night with Brad Silberling. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.